Accession number 21095, reel 25.
Afghanistan, I immediately rang the paper, and anyway, they dispensed with my services for another 2 or 3 days, and then I came back and started having to write about it. And of course, at the time, one aspect was the imposition of sanctions against the Soviet Union in retaliation, in response to the invasion of Afghanistan. Another thing were the contacts at the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where all the NATO countries, and indeed a great many other countries, condemned the Soviet intervention and really put the Soviet Union in the dock. And then there was the impact on the whole negotiating climate between the two superpowers, and of course the arms negotiations. It was a serious embarrassment, to put it mildly, for President Carter, who had staked much of his prestige on the improvement of relations with the Soviet Union during his presidency. And here was this setback, which had not been predicted as clearly as it, in retrospect, should have been done. I think it was on the cards, and American intelligence certainly should have been able to pick up more of what the Russian high the Soviet high command was planning to do in Afghanistan. But once it had happened, the whole question really was, how can any constructive dialogue with the Soviet Union continue when you have this blatant act which went against all the principles which, amongst other things, had been reinforced by the Helsinki Declaration, in which all the signatories committed themselves against intervention in the affairs of other sovereign states. And of course, all the commitments under the UN Charter and all the rest of it. And a lot of contacts were interrupted, were broken off. Then, of course, there was the great dilemma about the Olympic Games that were due to be staged that summer in Moscow. The Americans called for boycott. Various Western countries were reluctant to join the boycott. In the end, quite a few did go to the Olympic Games. And so it was quite tough for the Americans as well, because they suddenly saw that their ability to impose their policies on their partners was not as great as had been assumed. Countries were not prepared to fall into line quickly. Can you stop this for a minute? Yes, and one of the problems that Carter faced was to get ratification of the START Treaty, and one of the problems that Carter faced was to get U.S. Senate ratification of the SALT II Treaty, and he knew that he couldn't get it under the circumstances. And he, in fact, did not even attempt to table it before he went out, before he left office. I would really want to check on some of these details, because they are a bit hazy. I can't remember exactly how that went, though at the time it was all very important, and the whole issue of the ratification of that treaty remained a thorn that bedeviled U.S.-Soviet relations for quite a while, though after Gorbachev assumed power, I mean, after Brezhnev was followed by Andropov, and then Gorbachev only came into power in 86, and by that time the relationship was on the way to recovery again, and of course Gorbachev's arrival changed the whole changed all the atmospherics of the US-Soviet relationship, because it was seen that here was a new thinking was going on, and everyone got very excited by Gorbachev's commitment to perestroika and glasnost, and it was clear that all manner of reform was then put into motion, which did also greatly facilitate the arms control negotiations. As long as the Soviet military presence remained in Afghanistan, it had a negative impact on the relationship. Once they were out, then the atmosphere improved hugely, because it was seen as a defeat for the Soviet Union and for Soviet military power. Incidentally, something that only became known much later, when the minutes of some of the Politburo discussions became available, it became clear that most of the Soviet high command had rejected the idea of Soviet intervention in Poland in protest against Solidarity, while they still had this huge commitment in Afghanistan. They felt that the Soviet military power simply wasn't strong enough to open a second front. And that, in a way, also shows that to what extent the West, NATO, had overestimated the Soviet Union's conventional forces. It had not really occurred to them that the Russian command would oppose intervention in Poland on military grounds, on the grounds of overcommitment, because it was always assumed that they were so much more powerful than they really were. I think this is something that countries and governments spend a lot of time apologizing for past actions, but one can't say that they should apologize for misunderstanding the extent of Soviet conventional power. But certainly, I think that it is time that an acknowledgement was made of how wrong the assumptions have been on which so much of the conventional arms negotiations, and indeed the whole sort of estimates of the strategic balance, had been for so many years. And that includes the annual strategic surveys of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, whose annual military balance and strategic balance, the two major papers that they presented, really informed much of the debate that was in the public domain about the relative force of the relative military strength of the two big military blocs. And certainly I always treated those publications as a Bible, and not just journalists, but many experts throughout the world treated those things as the something that they could really rely upon completely, and certainly based on military intelligence and not just on intelligent guesswork. This may seem heretical, but it is so obvious in retrospect that so much was overestimated. The Russians may have had the strength that was attributed to them, but whether these were fighting forces, whether they were properly equipped, properly trained, whether they were mobile enough, whether they had the weaponry that was essential to any kind of real understanding of their importance and their strength. I mean, none of that seems to me was accurately assessed, and yet it dominated so much of the, not just the debates, but certainly of the arms negotiations for such a long time. And it was a misreading. So I think that is something that really bears looking at, and I'm sure has been looked at, but I think shouldn't really be discussed much more widely.
Yes,
no doubt historians will.
Yes. When you know, the events of 1989 occurred, and you know, leading to the sort of breakup of the Soviet Union, it's the, would you agree, the impression is that the West won the Cold War, but you're sort of indicating that it's very much more complex.
Well, of course, it was, I mean, you know, this was, you have to realise that this was the breakup of an empire. And you know, a superpower, at least you know, it wasn't. It really was only a superpower by virtue of the nuclear weaponry that it had. I mean, everybody's agreed on that. But it was also thought to be a superpower by virtue of the conventional forces that it had. And I think that is where things, where estimates went very much astray. And so much of nuclear armament was a consequence of what was thought to be the Soviet conventional threat in Europe against Germany and so on and so forth. But I think that, you know, that is where so much of the muddled thinking, as I would, I think, if one wanted to be kind about it, how that developed. But I think that the breakup of the Soviet empire, the Soviet bloc, it was due to many factors. Certainly the arms race had contributed to that, because the Russians had put so much of their resources into nuclear weaponry and into the arms race, that an economy that was anyhow backward, underdeveloped, underinvested in, with extremely poor, totally inadequate structures and communications, and so on and so forth, that that eroded the Soviet economy to an extent from which the Soviet Union obviously continues to suffer. I mean, the underinvestment in the civilian sector was just so gross and set the Soviet Union so far back and undermined enterprise and all the rest of it, that recovery, or not recovery, just growth and the achievement of prosperity is, you know, beyond reach for years, decades to come. So that was certainly one factor. To my mind, another factor was the Helsinki Declaration, the CSCE process, the fact that Western nations felt able to support dissident movements, encourage free speech, encourage people to voice their unhappiness, their criticism, their strictures on the regimes, to think about what was going on, to voice their thoughts. And of course, Gorbachev's arrival on the scene and his recognition that perestroika openness had to play a part if the Soviet Union was going to sort of enter the 20th century, never mind the 21st century. Once you opened up freedom of speech to some extent, of course you opened the sluice gates, and it came pouring out. And with that came the extraordinary restiveness in the communist bloc countries, and particularly, of course, in the GDR, this pressure to be allowed out of the cage and to get some, to secure some share of all the goodies that were floating around in the West, and, you know, this longing to go to the West, the Mecca, where they could work and money and acquire possessions, consumer goods, which they simply only saw in magazines from the West that were slowly drifting in. I mean, the less they were cut off from the West, the more they thought they saw the sort of consumer societies that the West had created, the more they wanted to be part of that. And there came a point when so many East Germans were trying to get out and were, you know, pushing at the wall, at the Berlin Wall, and trying to get out through other East European countries, that the genie was out of the bottle. And rather than have them try, it had become unstoppable. And Chancellor Kohl was amongst the first to realize that if without reunification, the German economy would suddenly be swamped by East Germans pouring into the West. So unification on the basis, of course, of the still very debatable exchange rate of one West German mark for one East German mark, those decisions had to be taken very rapidly if the situation was going to become, was not going to slip totally out of control. But I think all that I'm trying to say at this stage is that the collapse of the fall of the opening of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union afterwards were historical developments that had been created by a whole series of circumstances. I don't think there's any single factor that can explain what happened. But there was a kind of inevitability about it once a certain threshold had been breached, which unfortunately Gorbachev himself didn't realize. He became part of the problem rather than part of the solution in the end. Even though for a long time he had been the solution.
Yes, it was interesting. Seems a long time ago, Hella, but you were saying about Shevardnadze and how you felt that he did actually perceive that, you know, the inevitable results of perestroika.
I think I can't remember whether I'd said that before, but when I first really sort of interviewed Shevardnadze at length in Ottawa, which was at the very beginning of the 2+4 negotiations that led to the eventual agreement for the unification of Germany and the withdrawal of Soviet forces from East Germany and the Soviet Communist Bloc countries. But I'd come across Shevardnadze before, but in Ottawa, I asked to do an interview with him there for a full-length article for the Guardian, a big article for the Guardian, and out of the blue, I think the Russians told me that yes, he was prepared to do it, and it was going to be on an evening, and I was actually staying with the British High Commissioner in Ottawa. The negotiations were over, and I'd just gone to stay with them for a weekend afterwards. I mean, the sort of foreign minister's meeting to launch the 2+4 negotiations was over, and Shevardnadze had stayed behind for a day or two because I think he was going to visit or even address the Canadian Parliament. And so I was taken by a British High Commission car to the Soviet embassy in Ottawa, and I remember it was in the evening, and he had with him the interpreter who also worked for Gorbachev, who was a wonderful interpreter, and he interpreted so fast that you could almost have a dialogue with the person you were interviewing. And it went on for a very long time, I remember, and then at the end he took me to say hello to Mrs. Shevardnadze and all the rest of it. But I think it was then that, it was out of that interview that I really felt that Shevardnadze understood what was happening and how the whole thing had become quite unstoppable and how Gorbachev would have to agree to the unification of Germany. and that they would have to work out just simply the details of the withdrawal and of what would happen. You know, one of the big issues, of course, was whether the inclusion of East Germany would, to what extent that would affect German membership of NATO. And as long as the and whether any NATO forces could be stationed in East Germany, or whether they should draw the line, and the also of course the speed at which the Soviet forces would be withdrawn from East Germany and so on and so forth. But I mean, the basic political decision, I think, was quite clear to Shevardnadze, even though he knew that there would be a lot of opposition from the Politburo and from the Central Committee in Moscow. And I don't know, I don't remember asking him how Gorbachev would handle himself, but it was quite implicit that, you know, Shevardnadze saw that he, you know, that Gorbachev himself had to be convinced that that was the only available course to take. But that was a sort of really important interview, which you know, I think I said before, he afterwards acknowledged, he actually thanked me for having having written it. So that was always quite nice to hear.
Would you have been covering the visit of Gorbachev when he first made, you know, that great rapport with Margaret Thatcher?
Yes, I was there, and I remember there was a when Gorbachev came to England that first time in 85, you could see that he went to Chequers, and afterwards there was this curious photograph which I always remember, because Raisa was wearing dark tights and white shoes, and she looked so incredibly gauche. And Mrs. Thatcher, of course, was sort of lording it over everybody. But then there was a reception at the Savoy, to which I was invited, for Gorbachev. I think it was given by the Federation of British Industries, but I can't really remember, but I think it was more of a sort of business reception than a government reception. And I saw for the first time those absolutely steely eyes that he had. He made no real eye contact with you. He just you could see his eyes were somewhere else, and he didn't want you to talk to him. I found it very off-putting looking at him, though I realized that clearly he was a man of huge importance and significance, and certainly all the assessments that, in British briefings and so on were of some a new broom, and it was quite clear. But there was nothing very personable about him. He doesn't, and I don't think he ever did learn it either, to have the kind of personal charisma that President Clinton was able to exercise, so that every person that he ever spoke to felt that he'd known him all his life, or she had known him all his life, and Clinton was just addressing her. And again, with Shevardnadze, you felt he actually registered who you were, and he was talking with you. Gorbachev's charisma was different. I mean, Gorbachev had the aura of power plus the aura of the reformer, and I have no doubt at all that between him and Mrs. Thatcher there was a certain spark, which the rest of us could only observe from a distance, but those two clearly enjoyed talking with each other and paying attention to each other.
Did and you see that yourself in their meetings?
No, not really, no, I can't say that, but you could see it on watching television, and on the way she talked about him, and the way she was received, because after all, however much glasnost there may have been, a lot of the Soviet media was still very much under control, and she really was hailed as someone very special and someone very positive. And of course it was very interesting to see that these two opposites, who believed in totally different political, social, economic ideas, and somehow found each other challenging enough to have, I mean, those were debates. Unfortunately, the rest of us didn't hear them, but it was perfectly obvious that there were arguments and that they listened to each other and I assume learned from each other. I mean, she picked up something from him, I don't doubt that at all, and he certainly did from her. But what I think he didn't, and I'm sure this happened between Gorbachev and many other people, but what he didn't have was any kind of ability to project interest in strangers whom he was meeting for whatever reason he was meeting them. You always had a feeling he had to know precisely why he should be interested in you. And I think in the end it blinded him to Soviet realities. I mean, I did observe him in the Soviet Union, sort of crowds, working the crowds and so on. And yes, his speeches were always very mesmerizing, no doubt about that at all. But this sort of individual toing and froing with people, that was very alien to him. And I suppose, you know, he was conditioned to that. And I think Shevardnadze was out of character, but then, of course, he's a Georgian, and that makes a lot of difference, I think. But he certainly knew how to make the other person feel that he was just talking to them, which is a great political gift for a politician, and a great gift for a politician to possess.
Did you report ever on Yeltsin?
Not really, because Yeltsin, yes, I went to summits with Yeltsin. To that extent, I reported on him, but his emergence and all the events that surrounded his seizure of power, if you like, that was done by correspondence, Guardian correspondence in Moscow. And, you know, I was a consumer as much as anybody else. And I watched it and I read it and so on. But my involvement with Yeltsin is really just sort of just the extent of going to few summits in Moscow and in Washington, but not because by the time he became president, I was not so much involved with East-West relations anymore. I was doing much more general work and writing commentaries and that sort of thing, and not doing the sort of day-to-day reporting.
How did he impress you, though, Yeltsin?
I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about him, because I think my judgment on the whole is based on how he degenerated rather than what he achieved at the time. Yes, I mean, I think he had democratic instincts, and he was... he was as important a figure. I mean, I don't know how you would rank Gorbachev and Yeltsin. I mean, each in their time played, I mean, crucial roles in really changing the face of the former Soviet Union. I would still think, and that's probably an unfashionable and unpopular view to take, that Gorbachev of the two was the more important, because he was the one who triggered the really revolutionary change in the Soviet Union with the breakup of the Soviet Union, with the implicit in everything that he did. Gorbachev himself assumed that he could just reform communism without destroying it. I think to outsiders it became more and more obvious, long before it became obvious to him, that communism would self-destruct, and that he had unleashed a process which couldn't finish just in terms of a Soviet version of the Prague Spring of